Hello and welcome to the Intrafish Podcast, where we bring you the week's most interesting and compelling seafood news. I'm Editor-in-Chief Drew Cherry, and I'm joined today by Executive Editor John Fiorillo, late on a Friday afternoon when everyone is heading out the door, but we need to make sure that we get our podcast into your hands in time for cocktail hour, or at least in time for your coffee on Saturday morning. So, hello, John. We had a big week of news today, this week, and we have another big week coming up. So we took a couple of topics that we want to drill down into a little bit for our podcast listeners. Two interesting things. One story that you did today on the Dungeness crab fishery. Now, crab is one of those topics that sort of flies under the radar. It's not a product that's traded to the same activity as salmon all over the world, but it is a product that everyone knows, everyone's aware of. It has a certain cachet when you are served crab. People tend to think that this is kind of a special thing. And there have been some severe supply issues heading into this this year that's really impacting the U.S. market. And we're going to discuss climate change in a moment because that factors into the supply issues. But John, first, just tell us about the Dungeness crab fishery. It's here on the west coast of the United States. Popular crab, but certainly not as well known as, say, king crab. But because we have a shortage of king crab this year, Dungeness is going through the roof. Tell us about it.
Well, it's lucky that it's been a really good season off the West Coast, particularly Oregon, which tends to be the leader in Dungeness crab harvesting. You know, along the West Coast, they do fish in Washington, and they do fish in California as well. But Oregon tends to be out in front. Anyway, so this season, the season is just 8 weeks in, and they've already surpassed the record for ex vessel value for crab landings, and that they're at 74.5 million, surpassing the old record of 74.2 in the 2017-2018 season. But that was for the entire season there. This is only 8 weeks in, so the season runs through August. And although most of it is caught in this first 8 weeks, there's still going to be more catch, you know, between now and when it closes. So that that 74 million number is gonna rise even further. Fishermen, they're getting paid an average of just over $5 a pound, and that's really good. And I think, you know, the point you were making that, you know, we have no red Bristol Bay king crab fishery this year. The Opelio quota in Alaska, that's snow crab, has been cut almost 90%. So there's a lot less crab in general in the market. And it's a market that really wants crab. I was shocked to see some of these figures, but you know, retail scan data from 210 Analytics, which looks at the IRI scan data and compiles information on seafood and other things. In 2021, fresh crab sales, and that's all crab, exceeded 1.24 billion in the U.S. retail segment. That's 59% higher than the same time, same sales in 2019 before the pandemic. So the point being that shellfish in general, but crab specifically, has done really well since the onset of the pandemic. I have some theories on that, but and just in general, that's the case.
So I'm going to go back a little bit to Bristol Bay and the Red King crab season, because that what we're seeing in the crab market was this jump is in part predicated on this cancellation. It's the first time the Bristol Bay Red King crab season has been canceled in over 25 years. And it was basically regulators at the Alaska Department of Fish and Game and the National Marine Fisheries Service did trawl surveys and looked at the biomass, and it was just below the threshold for what they for what they've set for opening a fishery. Now, that in itself is a big deal. Obviously, king crab is something that everybody wants on their table. When you talk about Dungeness crab, yes, it's I think getting more of a name for itself in part because of these king crab shortages. But there's nothing quite like having a king crab leg there on your plate, and that's globally. That's why it's a species that does very, very well in Russia. That's why it does. Why Norway now has its own fishery there. It's actually an invasive fishery, which is kind of interesting. Russian scientists actually tried to get it to grow on the East Coast and brought it over from the Pacific. And whoops, it spread all over the place across Norway. And now even into the UK, I was just reading. But let me talk a bit about the king crab prices, because we're looking at a massive spike in king crab prices that tells you kind of the overall pressure. This is even before the cancellation. So let's just look back let's go back to 2002. Just so we get a nice 20-year span here. So ex-vessel price per pound, that's the amount paid to the fishermen. In 2002, it was $6.21 a pound for red king crab. Now, going to 2020, which is the most recent statistics we have available, it was $11.89. That's paid to the fishermen. That's not what you see in the grocery stores. So we're talking about double what it was 20 years ago, and really no signs that it's going to slow down. The trend, I'm looking here in front of me, is going right through the roof. So is there, do you think, John, I mean, is there any, what is sort of the limit on what people will pay for crab here? Why do you think, you said you had a theory, why do you think people continue to sort of shell out this kind of, that was unintentional. Why do you think people tend to, are shelling out this kind of money, and will they continue to do so?
Yeah, I don't know. You know, every price has, every buyer has a limit after a while. I mean, and you know, $12 a pound ex vessel, that puts it in a retail store for $24 to $30 probably a pound. And that's a lot, but it's interesting to note this surge in crab sales since the pandemic, because at least for the first part of the pandemic, I'll say the first year almost, food service was shut down. And most crab, most people don't fix crab at home. They go out and they have it at dinner, especially king crab. And of course, snow crab is really big with Red Lobster and some of the chains. So you know, I sat there and I thought last night, I'm like, well, why would it take off given that one of its main channels was shut down? And then I thought to myself, well, how hard is it to fix crab? It's simple. I mean, if you go and you buy a crab leg at the grocery store and bring it home, virtually all you have to do is thaw it out. It's ready to go. It's cooked. And, you know, there's some fresh crab, but most of it's all cooked and ready to go. I mean, you can heat it, you can steam it, you can do some other preparations with it, but it is probably the easiest seafood in the world to cook or to prepare. I mean, literally. So I think, you know, you keep hearing all this about consumers finally learn how to cook seafood at home. I think a lot of them finally discovered how easy crab is to do at home, and they bought the heck out of it. The retail data proves it. But now we're at that point. You saw in 2021, sales and crabs softened a little bit compared to 2020. They were still above 2019 considerably, but you can see probably now we're reaching a point where maybe, you know, the prices are too high. I mean, the prices I see in the grocery store are, to me, they're very high, but you know, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, you can just do a quick online search and see what people are charging for crab. And it's what I would consider obscene, But then again, like you said, John, people are out there buying it. So people are willing to pay this amount of money. Okay. Good on the crab sellers if that works.
Yeah, I mean, if you want to have a cool meal at home, you know, maybe something special. I mean, even if it's, say, $27 a pound for king crab, let's just say, I don't know what it is right now. But, you know, you can get two, maybe three crab legs for that. And crab is really rich. I mean, if it's just you and another person, for example, two or three crab legs is more than enough if you have other, you know, sides and all that nonsense. But yeah, no, I don't know. It's very interesting. I really want to call some people who study the retail sales and ask this question about crab. But that's for another week.
Yeah. The interesting thing too, as I said, even though there is or largely because there is a shortage, what you're seeing now is global markets really heating up too. And so our Russian correspondent, Evgeny Vovchenko, wrote a good story about this late last year. He interviewed some of the Russian Far East crabbers. And what's very interesting is they see the shortfall in Bristol Bay. They see the shortfall on the U.S. market. And they're just going right after it. And they are exporting a lot of product into the United States, trying to take advantage of that. And you're just seeing that everywhere. Again, it's a market that for Norway, for example, taking an invasive species, now it's a managed, very profitable fishery, just because the demand is so high for crab around the world. And so you're seeing all of these species that have traditionally not been considered premium crab fetching a lot more money. Things like Opelia and snow crab, a step down, I think most chefs would say, and most people would say, from king crab, but same. Big price pressure as people go out and want to get more of it. So good times if you're harvesting crab, that's for sure.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
So one of the things that I mentioned, the invasion of king crabs in Norway, one of the things that we're seeing, and crab is certainly a part of this, is changes because of climate change. Crabs, you know, crawl along the bottom of the ocean. They move away from conditions they don't like. They move toward food sources, and all these shifts mean that that you're seeing changes in their habitat, just as you are with other fish and aquaculture as well, which is something that is kind of not really discussed when you look at climate change, at least broadly, but we've certainly paid a lot of attention to it. One of the big things that that impacts aquaculture in terms of climate change are algal blooms. So when these algal blooms happen, they're amplified by warmer waters and sunlight. They can float right in the water column where salmon, for example, and in this case, we are going to talk about salmon, where salmon are in their net pens, and they'll just go right through a water column. They get trapped in the gills, essentially suffocate the salmon, and they can kill off hundreds of thousands of fish just like that. And so it's an issue that we've seen sometimes take just a devastating toll on the industry. So over the past few years, we've seen some just kind of stunning outbreaks in Chile just a few years ago, about $800 million in estimated losses from a massive outbreak. Around 100,000 metric tons of salmon was killed off. And just a couple of years ago in Norway, another massive bloom that that led to tens of millions of dollars in losses, and I think around 15,000 metric tons of salmon was lost there. So it's something that the industry, I think, is quite concerned about. This year in Chile, part of why it was this year's algal bloom in Chile that just popped up, part of why it was such a concern, not only did it kill around 3,500 metric tons of salmon at several major salmon farming companies, Blumar, Salmonis Austral, Comanchaca, and Aqua Chile, not only did it cause those losses, but this is very, very early. So the Chile Salmon Council, Joanna Davidovich, she's the executive director. She said that's the big concern right now among the industry, is that it happened so early. But John, we've also talked to people about some of the mitigation that is mitigation techniques that are available. There's new technologies. What do we know about some of the ways that monitoring or some of this tech can help salmon farmers out, and how far along is it?
Yeah, before I get there, I just want to put this all in perspective, because you know, you talked about climate change and its impact across multiple species, salmon, crab, etc. You and I have been writing about seafood for a while. It is now at the point where there is, and this blows my mind. I was talking to John Evans, our reporter in Brazil, who wrote this story. It blows my mind that we now have an algal bloom season. I mean, wrap your head around that a little bit. Like, we didn't have this. I don't remember it 5 years ago. Maybe it was just coming on. I certainly don't remember it 10, 15 years ago. We now have a season for algal blooms in Chile. And, you know, I don't know. It just struck me as really bizarre that it's come to these types of levels as far as climate change is concerned. But to answer your question, you know, with seasons of algal blooms, companies have to address this. They have to figure out how to mitigate the damage, because like you said, there's hundreds of millions of dollars at stake here. So, you know, there's a lot of money going into some preventative measures to be able to predict when the blooms are coming and maybe adjust operations somehow, if possible. There's monitoring, new technology for monitoring the oxygen in the tanks, and there's a bubble. It's called a bubble barrier system, where they can actually, you know, kind of prevent the impact of the bloom by using what they call a bubble curtain, and basically tiny little bubbles that kind of block things. So there's a lot of investment money going in this direction. You know, a lot of the funds out there, and they're investing small amounts, I guess, relatively, but you know, everybody is looking for some sort of answer to this. So, you know, hopefully we don't end up at a stage where certain parts of Chile or Norway or anywhere become, you know, where you just can't farm there anymore because of this. I don't want to suggest we're there by any means, and I hope that never comes. But, you know, we have to consider that, you know, places in the ocean that we probably took for granted for a long time as being bountiful and, you know, from a harvest point of view or a farming point of view, you know, that may not always be the case.
You know, digging into our archives here, John, and looking at when we first started writing about algal blooms and first mentioned them, it's about in 2000 that we reported our first story on an algal bloom in Chile. Took out some quite a few fish, you know, not a massive amount. We reported in 1999 there was one that led to the loss of about 300,000 salmon, and this one in 2000 was around 150,000. What strikes me though is that we haven't really come very far in mitigation techniques. You know, even at that time, there was discussions of, okay, we'll put polyethylene aprons in to keep the algae away. We'll use compressed air in the same way that you would in a fish tank. You know, it seems like it's a problem that, as John wrote in his story, one of the experts there said, it's not something that is high on the priority list. It's probably going to get higher, but when you have so many different diseases that salmon deal with, you also have sea lice, which is the number one issue. Algal blooms seem like they're sort of down on the lower on the list, but it probably should be lifted up quite a bit higher on the list, given what you just mentioned about there now being an algal bloom season that rolls around. And, you know, every summer when the weather starts heating up, it appears that companies can really expect that they're going to experience some losses unless they have some mitigation techniques. So, you know, it's going to be interesting to see what people come up with. Like you said, there's different types of technologies, these bubble curtains and things. But yeah, I don't know to what extent the industry is going to be willing to invest in these more expensive technologies at this time.
Yeah, I imagine. I'm surprised too that we reported on that almost 20 years ago. But I think the difference is those were probably more or less random events, as opposed to now something that's become more predictable. And I suppose, you know, the investment in those technologies you mentioned are going to be a function of the frequency and severity of algal blooms. If those two variables should continue to increase, then the urgency to address them will increase, obviously, and the investment in technologies to do that. So hopefully that, you know, hopefully we don't ever get there, but it sure feels like, you know, that we may be headed in that direction to some degree.
Well, it's going to spur some of these developments in, for example, closed containment production, offshore production. And again, I think that's you are seeing necessity being the mother of invention on some of these, some of this tech that seems advanced, and it seems, wow, you know, we're going to move to these, you know, offshore systems that are massive out there floating on the water or below the surface. You know, we're going to be moving to those much quicker, I think, than many both inside and outside of the industry think, because of these types of events. And that's it's good in the sense that it seems companies are beginning to recognize that it's good to start investing in this technology now rather than waiting until the conditions become much more complicated for raising in nearshore net pens.
I know, but think about that statement. You're doing this in effect because the system you've been using since the 80s is maybe breaking down because of climate change at a rate that, you know, you're not going to be able to use it the way you could. I mean, that's getting a little ahead of ourselves probably, but your point is the point, right? You're looking to go further offshore to avoid, you know, sea lice and water temperature changes. And you know, it is what it is. It's hard to argue that we're looking for ways to work around the problems that seem to be intensifying, you know?
It's very interesting that climate change is going to be such a driver of how the industry looks, not just from a technological point of view, but when you look at these investments that companies have to make, they're massive capital investments. And so what that will mean is the smaller companies that are operating in conventional net pens, they will not be able to afford this kind of mitigation technology. There's only so much that insurers are going to put up with as time goes on. I think, you know, if your house is built next door to a volcano, there's only so much volcano insurance that a company is going to give you. So I think that I think that's what's going to be really, really interesting, is just how climate change will have the ability to completely reshape industries. Aquaculture in the ocean anyway, is one of those. And again, it spurs other technologies and other changes. For example, land-based salmon, which continues to at least attract a lot of capital. Part of why there is a case to be made, I think, for land-based salmon is exactly what we're talking about, is that climate change is going to force companies to change the way that that they're used to raising fish. Well, let's wrap it up there. Just a reminder, February 17th is our shipping and logistics digital event. You can register for that at intrafishevents.com. We'll be bringing some experts together to give a look at what the industry might be able to expect in shipping and logistics in the coming year. There's been so many hiccups and issues and challenges, so our experts are going to try to shed some light on what things are going to look like over the next year. All right, folks, thanks for joining, and we'll speak to you next week.